The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Glenda Gilson became the second celebrity to exit Dancing with the Stars. She dropped by studio with dance partner Robert Ravinsky to look back at her time in the competition. Rudolf Huss was the notorious chief commander at Auschwitz. His grandson, Rainer Huss, spoke to me about taking ownership of the past so that we don't repeat the same mistakes. Kelly Doyle trained under controversial yogi guru Bikram Chowdhury and joined me in studio to give an insight into this extreme form of hot yoga and the man behind it. David Diebold was only 7 years old when he found out that the woman he thought was his sister was in fact his mother. He spoke to me about dealing with family secrets and complicated histories. And Danny Miller, who communicates through augmentative communication technology, told me about the difference having a voice has made to his life. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy it.
Dancing with the Stars on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
Well, it was movie night on Dancing with the Stars last night, and sadly the final credits rolled for Glenda Gilson. Good morning, Glenda.
Good morning.
And your pro partner, Robert Ravinsky. Good morning, Robert. Nice to see you again.
Good morning.
And thank you for coming. Did you have, Glenda, any inkling that, you know, in your bones that maybe this was going to be as short-lived as it was, or had you higher hopes?
Listen, I kind of always put myself down when it came to this competition. I thought I was going home even when there wasn't any eliminations, Ryan. But look, you kind of get into it, and I was getting into it. You know, I found the whole process tough, and I really enjoyed last night. And then to go was when we were, like myself and Rob, we seem to have these big conversations when it comes to elimination time. So the two of us were standing there. Rob's like, I think we're going. Oh my God, my hands are sweating.
Then I love the accent.
Yeah. It's a close approximation.
It's almost actually polished.
To a Mexican.
So, and then when it came down to the last three, myself and Rob kind of went, here we go. And I kind of thought it was going to be me, all right, yeah.
Robert, let me ask you about your feelings this morning as the pro dancer. You've had great success on the dance floor in the past with Cleona Hagen and Maya Dunphy, and you know, you always bring your A game to this competition. So last night, were you shocked?
Yeah, of course I was. You know, I think we both were shocked a bit, you know, because we, especially Glenda, like she improved every week dancing, and dancing wise and how we were in the competition, you know, I thought that we'd stay much, much longer though.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear you say that. What I'm quite struck by, and I don't want to be, you know, dissing Father Ray, but I will say that the listeners are really unhappy that they feel like, okay, it's fun and all, but you've got to do a bit more than what he did. And I'll give you a flavour of that. And, you know, we all know he's a very nice man.
Absolutely.
He's only having a bit of fun, so let's not be jumping up and down on top of him. But just people take this stuff seriously, okay? Yeah. And they're watching it at home. I'll give you a little favour and we can reflect that. Carmel says, tell Glenda she is beautiful and gracious and she danced like a swan last night. Her exit was the most unjust of all. The volatile public are obviously rigged for that ridiculous result. Well, of course, they're not. But I accept what you're saying in terms of why you're annoyed. Anyway, it's a travesty, says a text. Glenda's dance routine was practically flawless. She was so gracious. And when the result was announced, a real lady of pure class. You're coming out of this very well. This is a very lengthy one from Philip. I'm writing about the show. I've been watching the program since day one. I'd be a big fan of the program. I was aghast at the shocking elimination of Glenda Gilson. Father Ray Kelly should have been given his marching orders last night, not Glenda. No ill feelings towards Father Ray, but he cannot dance. And compared to the other candidates such as Glenda, she should still be in the competition. I wish Glenda and Robert all the very best, but they were robbed of a chance of getting to stay longer in the competition. And who is, asks Jacinta, who is voting for Father Ray? Has he not the good grace to withdraw? He's an embarrassment. And that's just a little flavour of it. People are kind of annoyed. One more says, I'm loving the programme, but Glenda should not have been sent home. She was doing great and so lovely physically and in the chats. She'll be sorely missed. Father Ray must have some special powers to be in there. Well, he's a priest. what more do you want? He's got the. There's the parish. Well,
that's what I was going to say to you. It's the public that are keeping Father Ray in there. You know, as yeah. Louis Walsh always says, this is not a dance show. This is an entertainment show. You know, he's staying in there. People want to see him, more of him. And as well, the Irish have this great thing of going, oh my God, I can't believe that it didn't happen. But you have to ask the question, did you vote? Oh,
yeah.
You know, like, you got to text or pick up the phone and vote for
this
people.
Is it.
You know?
I think people give out about politics. I'm taking it into another level. And you say, who did you vote for? I didn't vote. Well, then be quiet.
Yeah, yeah,
you
exactly.
You barely have a right to talk about
it. And you know what? Father Ray, fair play to him, is getting through it. But he's had his up days and his down days. You know, we've all kind of throughout the last few weeks had our panics. And Father Ray, you know, he went through it last week. He did, you know, he's having good days and bad
days,
like us all.
And across the water, in their version of the programme, often a sack of spuds in a suit has done very well because it's a bit of crack
as
well.
That's it.
How do you feel about the Louis Walsh mantra that it's not a dance competition, it's an entertainment show?
Now, I always feel this one, that it's both, you know, like it's also about dancing a little bit, you know, because if you delivered perfect dancing, they will be still in the competition. But in the same time, it's an entertainment show. So, you know, like we actually like thinking about this, like very light about that, you know, like we don't have a pressure about that.
Okay. And now, Glenda, are your dancing days behind you? Is this the end, or have you been introduced to a whole new world?
Oh my God! As I said, I found it tough. I don't think I'll be cha-chaing up the street anytime soon now. And of course,
what you mean?
I had to hold on to Rob for dear life when I was dancing. Yeah. So certainly not.
I thought, if I may say so, watching you last night, you gave a masterclass in dignity in departure.
Ah, thanks.
I really mean that. It was nice because sometimes some people find it quite hard to pull
it
together.
But Ron, I found even being critiqued by the judges weird. You know, it was like, Glenda, in future, keep your legs straight. And I was kind of finding myself getting embarrassed, as they telling me. It was like...
Did you want to say that in future, you keep your legs straight?
No, not that. It was just like, I was just kind of mortified at someone telling me, you know, in future, when you're dancing, you know, hold your posture. I'm like, really? Are they speaking to me? You know?
It's great. But no regrets. Is that be fair
Absolutely
to say?
Absolutely not. I really enjoyed it. You know, it's such an experience. That show, it was great.
Well handled, Glenda. Thank you, Robert. Thank you again.
Thank you.
To you both. And
cheers, Ryan.
Cha 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 for the future. All right. Today, over 200 survivors will gather at Auschwitz to commemorate the 75th anniversary of its liberation, reminding, and of course, urging the world to never forget the horrors of the Holocaust. On the line now from Stuttgart is a man whose mission is to do just that, despite his own difficult past and the sins of his notorious grandfather. Rainer Huss, good morning to you.
Good morning to be invited here.
Could you begin by telling us straight up who you are and your link to German history?
I'm the grandson of Rudolf Höss, who was the former and founder of the Auschwitz extermination camp in 1940. So he was responsible for more than 1.3 million killings in that camp.
It's an extraordinary opening gambit to a conversation. I don't know where to begin in some ways, but perhaps you could tell us as much as you know about, and as much as we know, about your grandfather.
Yeah, so... He runs the Auschwitz extermination camp. So when he went there, it was only some few barracks from the soldiers left out of the First World War. And then he creates it out of 25,000 square meters, a size of 93 square kilometers. Mm-hmm. And he became a famous person. I know it's not the right term to say a famous person, but in history or in what we educate today, he organized the industrial planned and fulfilled final solution for the Nazis in the way that he used the Cyclone B to gas people in a short period. So, and his name became, in a way, in the Nazi regime, a high level about the Hungarian solution in 1944, when he killed in 56 days more than 400,000 people by gas.
I want to talk about your father. He was born in 1937, one of five children who grew up in the large villa near Auschwitz. I saw it last month. It's so close to the camp, it's beyond understanding until you see it, I suppose, in some ways. Can you, from your study of history and from visiting the camp and so forth, tell our listeners, please, Rainer, about the villa and life in the villa?
So my grandfather went over the first time to Auschwitz, or today called Oswiecim, to visit it and to find out what he can do for the final solution. And it was planned on the beginning to become an agriculture system to feed all the soldiers who overruns the East. And he occupied that villa, and I'm in touch with the daughter. So that means that the original owner of that villa, she is now in her, a little bit older than her 80s. Mm-hmm. It was the first time a Hus after the war visited that villa again. So I jumped in, and for me it was important to see, well, it was all that kind of denying all the time and glorification about my grandfather, what my father really saw in that period. So when I went in and opened the window, and I saw everything. I saw the gas chamber, I saw the crematoria, I saw the hanging spots. So if people not were there, so you saw everything. So how can a kid grow up in that environment with activities around? And then I spoke to people like Joseph Paczynski, he was the barber of my grandfather, and asked him if there were walls around when he came to Auschwitz in 1940. He said no, everything was open. So the walls were built up in 1941. So when the kids, they had signs around their neck with the names on it so that they not get mixed up with any transports from different countries with Jews or prisoners at all. So, and the kids, they grow up in an environment where they have everything. They have ponds, they have different animals. And what was really specific, like the saying of my grandmother, that she said to the kids with the greenhouses, so before you eat the vegetables or the fruits, you have to wash it while it's full of ash. So there was one really pregnant thing in that way. So you were there, I know it. And it's nearly 100 meters away from the crematoria. Mm-hmm. And you said, sometimes it was really strange when all the black smoke came over and it was a disgusting smelling, so about burning human flesh. But she called that part paradise. And that was one of my major questions in my research. If she called it her paradise, how must hell look for her in that way?
Extraordinary description, to be honest with you. I'm flabbergasted, but this is what why this conversation is so important, to remind ourselves of just how dark that period of history was. When did you discover, as the grandson, how old were you when you got an indication as to who your grandfather was?
It's several steps. So the first time I realized or came close to that name, Rudolf Höss, was in a boarding school. Yeah, as a kid, you a little bit, make troubles. So we did that as well with my roommates, and we stole food in the kitchen. We're caught, sent to the director, and have to get that, became like a delinquent for him, and have to work in the garden with the gardener. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't know in that moment was that he was a prisoner in the villa of my grandfather of 30 of other prisoners. So when he saw that name on the list, which was given by the secretary to him, that he knows which kids he has. So he saw that name and he called back and said, okay, can you tell me what's the name of his father, of that kid? And she said immediately, it's Hans-Jürgen. So, and then it was clear, I'm one of her siblings. So now revenge took place in my life.
Really?
And I had no clue about Rudolf Höss, about concentration camps, Nazi regimes. It was not taught in my age in that year or in that period.
I think it was books in your house that alerted you to more information.
Yeah, that comes. That was the second step. So to finish, the first step was after we were sentenced for 2 weeks to work with a gardener. Mm-hmm. And I worked there for over 3 months. And always with these sayings, you're not good enough, you work not good enough, you have not enough patience and things like that. So, and my German teacher took me out of that course of trouble and said, okay, a few days later, are you interested to visit with me a concentration camp like Dachau? So I had no clue about a concentration camp. For me, it was important. Well, he offered me to go there with his motorbike. Mm-hmm. So that was more important for me in my age, in between 10 and 11. So we went there, and if you visit Dachau first time, so you go, enter the by the gate, you enter and go in. And then you have these barracks around, and everywhere was these blocks in these, showed Rudolf Höss, worst criminal in the 20th century, responsible for millions of killings. So, of course, I was a little bit shocked. So then we went back home, and immediately I called my father and asked him how that guy belongs to us, if it's part of our family. And he said, no, it's a spelling mistake. It should called Rudolf Höss with E, not with that umlaut we have in Germany, like they always the 2 points on it. Mm. So then the situation was cleared up for me in that moment. Then I started my training as a cook, came home, and that was in an age of 15. And my mom had the hallway filled up with bookshelves, so she reads a lot. And then I went up to put my dirty gloves away, and I saw these two books, The Commandant of Auschwitz, Memoirs of Rudolf Höss, and the other one was People in Auschwitz from Hermann Langbein, a survivor. So the first thing which runs through my mind was, wow, they made a spelling mistake again. So from Hess to Höss. So how can that happen? And before I could grab these books out of the shelf, my father was next to me, and he, believe me, he was not really a sports guy in his life, and got slapped left and right, and then it was clear something went wrong. I went down to my mom and asked her and said, what means all of it? And he said, okay, your dad is leaving for a business meeting, and then you will get these books. And exactly what she did. She gave me the books. I read both books. I was completely shocked what happened to the family and that everybody is denying it. And then I left my home in an age of 15.
And you were trying to, I suspect, process the magnitude of what you were, what you had learned. How did you do that? How did you feel knowing the bloodline?
I think it starts really, in some ways difficult and cruelty for me. I started with alcohol and drugs, and I was really a brutal guy in my youth. So whenever somebody came along and only looks on the wrong side on me, he gets slapped. So I was really not that nice kid anymore. And then I became a father in the age of 17. And this again turns my life completely around. So it was clear I have to take a stand now for my family. And I started researching with it. And another point, my mentor in the job where I became a cook, he was a kid out of the Lebensborn. I think the translated a bit means a breeder home of the Nazis. Blonde and blue-eyed kids generated by blunt couples.
Yes.
So the kid was taken away and grown up isolated. So, and he was one of these Lebensborn kids. So he knows everything about my name and what happens to the in the Nazi regime with my family, with his family. So and he helped me a lot in the first years to grow and to get as much as possible information about my grandfather. So, and that became in some ways really, I would call myself addicted to history now.
I understand that. Did you, at the young age of 17, did you find, Rainer, that having a family was critical to your story, to have a family of your own?
It's difficult as well to explain. Well, it's like a drop-by-drop system over years now. My family itself, so my own family, I think they were my life. They keep me alive. If I would stay longer in the Höss family, they would really poison my brain with all that indoctrination of it. So I was happy to get out of it. And then I became the black sheep in my family.
Can you understand, Rainer, why your father and his siblings claimed they did not know what was happening in the camp, despite the description you've just given us of proximity, smells, environment, etc.?
I think that belongs to my grandmother. So my grandfather wrote his memoirs, which, and I say it right now, I wrote a book about it. The second book with 1,600 pages where I clean up the lines completely from his birth until his end. And there were a lot of lies in it, which he wrote himself. So, like he testified, he was a soldier in the First World War. That's a big lie. And a lot of other things which became more and more interesting in public. But for the kids itself, I think it's a kind of indoctrination they had out of that Nazi period. So they grow up in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that now many times. So I'm in touch with several afterborn Nazis, like Niklas Funk. His father was a general governor in occupied Poland, and he creates the ghettos there. So, and they all have in some ways the same ideology inherited. So you cannot get them out. And what I found out as well is the third generation is that generation who deals with it, has to deal with it. The impact on my father and his sisters, I think it's so high. And as well that my grandmother never moved away a step. She glorified my grandfather until her suicide in 1989. She committed suicide in Washington, D.C., and now she is buried on a Jewish cemetery under her kid name, Hensel. So that is something which I really cannot stand at the moment, that she is buried there.
You described growing up as home being hell on earth. Why was that, Rainer?
I think that belongs as well to my father. But after my research, I found out that my grandfather never slept his kids.
Mm-hmm.
So he really... They had a beloved childhood. So, and then I asked myself why he slept us. Mm. What was that turning point in his life that he became that brutal guy, that his only communication system was his 120-meter long brown leather belt to explain things to us? I don't really have a clue why it happens. And I never spoke to him since 1985. And I will not speak to anybody of the Höss family anymore. It's really, that's past for me, that family.
Why?
I cannot live with that nonsense that he never made anything wrong, that it was okay and he was not a commandant of an extermination camp. He was a commandant of a prison. So how can I deny things like that? And in all that research I made, I found the names which were really close to my family, like Professor Fourisson, one of the biggest Holocaust deniers in the world. And I found blogs where he mentioned my aunt in America who delivered images and said, no, nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And he said they had enough food, nothing went wrong, so they never get beaten up. Everything was really beautiful for these persons. Yeah, but they were in prison, they make something wrong.
Why did you keep your grandfather's name when a lot of people might have said it's time to change it?
Would you invite me to your show if I would call myself Mr. Müller?
No,
I don't think so.
No, I probably wouldn't know who you are. But you make a good point.
Yeah, but if I use my family name, I have no problem with it. I never made anything wrong in the Second World War. I was not even born in it. But to use it as a tool and as a good weapon against the far right and all these revisionists, racists, that's the point in it.
It is the point. I understand that entirely. You've been in touch with, you're still in touch with the 176 survivors of the Holocaust all over the world. And you've made a very, very curious point, which was that children of survivors are more belligerent towards you than the survivors.
I tried. In some ways, in my research, I looked for a way not to glorify my grandfather as well, but to get in touch with survivors. And two really interesting persons I'm in such a close contact to was Eva Moses Korsch. She passed away last year on her trip to Auschwitz when she was there with different people to give a tour. She adopted me in 2014. And she said, okay, Rudolf Höss cannot enjoy his grandson, but I can. And you need a grandmother. So now it's good you have a Jewish grandmother. And Ben Lesser, he reads an article about me in the Wall Street Journal, 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And he was shaking in fear when he reads the name Höss again. He said, oh, God. So, and he gave the, in yeah, and said to his daughter, Gail, you have to find that young man. So he reads the article to the end and said, oh, he's doing exactly the same what I'm doing. So we have to find him. I have to talk to him. And that happens a day later. We were in touch and we're still in touch. We share a lot of projects together. We go together in schools. And I think that's the way of changing things. In Germany, I saw that many times that people are not really able to understand what it means that a Holocaust survivor and the grandson of his tormentor stand together on stage and give a testimony out, which I never saw before in the world in that way. So it's a huge impact.
And Rainer, can I ask you in conclusion, what do you see as the most important lesson for listeners to this program, for students who go to your talks and so on? What do you want them to take away from what you have to say?
So first of all, I have one sentence I always use in schools. Be a voice, not an echo. So not take a stand with thousands of others. Go your own way. Make your research. Ask your questions. When you're not really believing it, don't follow the masses. And like you have right now in England, where thousands of people follow the message and they believe in all these lies. So it becomes a Brexit. If they wouldn't believe in it, if they would question it, that never would happen. And that's what I deliver to the students. Open, go in life with open eyes. Well, with closed eyes, it's easy living. Not look around, not take care about people around, like the refugees, migrants. These people are all human beings. And nobody really asked that question as well. Why we have refugees? Why they are coming to our countries? They not want to come, of course not. But they have to. Well, we deliver weapons. And we not really take care to take the goods and all that stuff out of their country without looking about them. Mm-hmm. And on the end, we have a war, another war. And it's going on and on and on.
Rainer, it's been extraordinary talking to you. I hope you'll come and see us the next time you might be in Ireland and we'll have a longer conversation.
Oh, I will.
Yeah, I'd like that very much. Yeah, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you for your time this morning. Wish you well.
Thank you.
Thank you kindly. Bye-bye for now. Rainer Huss there joining us on the show this morning. And what a fascinating story he has to tell. We appreciate him telling it so well for us today. Right, the text number is 51551. It's 27 minutes past nine now. There is an intriguing documentary that you might have seen about a controversial yogi guru called Bikram Chowdhury. And he introduced his yoga practice, Bikram Yoga, in the States in the 1970s, which at its peak earned him millions and millions of dollars. And although he's dogged by controversy, he continues to teach, although this time outside of the United States, having left there. We'll explain that in a minute. But Kelly Doyle trained under Bikram in 2018, and she joins us now. Good morning,
Kelly.
Good
morning.
We were just intrigued because, as I say, the documentary had us all talking, and we'd heard of Bikram yoga. We know it. We've heard of yoga. And we just thought, seeing as you were in the room, we thought we'd bring you in to tell us a little bit about that. First of all, how does somebody decide I want yoga in my life of any description?
Well, for me, it started about 10 years ago. I knew there was something missing in my life.
Oh, right.
I was going to the gym. I was running. I have a love-hate relationship with running. Everybody knows that at this stage. So, but there was something missing. And then I just happened upon yoga, to be honest with you, and I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
I hadn't practiced or anything. It was quite new into the world, into Ireland, you know, at that stage. So I was basically browsing the internet one evening, and I came across this yoga studio down in Clare, the Burn Yoga Centre, and they were doing retreats. So I said, well, if I don't know anything about yoga, I'm going to submerge myself in it, and maybe for a weekend. So I ended up going down for 5 days. And Michael Ryan, I don't know if you're familiar with him, he's a yoga teacher, he's a great Irish yoga teacher. He was down there, and of course I knew nothing about the downward dog, I knew nothing. They were asking me to get into postures, and I was like, you want me to do what now?
Yeah.
So, and I was constantly being adjusted, I'd be in a posture, and I could hear him coming towards me, and I go, God, not again, I'm doing this wrong. So anyway, that led to me, once I came back from that weekend, I was hooked.
Yeah.
So I decided to take up yoga classes, and I went to the Crown Centre, it was called down, it's now Yago Yoga, and I took classes there. And then I decided, well, listen, I became very passionate about it because I could see what it was doing for me, how it was changing my life. I still had problems with meditation. Like, I'd be sitting there, I mean, trying to meditate and, you know, God, did I take that out of the fridge? What am I going to have for dinner type of thing? You know, okay. That way all these thoughts
your
are going
mind,
through.
Yeah.
So I still struggle with that.
Okay.
But, and then I decided, yeah, I wanted to teach. So I did a 200-hour Hatha yoga teacher training over a period of 2 years. It was once a month. You went and you spent the weekend there and you were immersed in a bubble.
Okay.
And it felt amazing. You know, and it slotted in with my life. It helped me in times of stress. I'd turn to it, I'd roll out my mat, you know, every evening, maybe in the morning times, and it was just a place for me to go.
You say 10 years ago, you obviously had stuff going on in your life, was it?
Sure.
Was it difficult or...?
Well, I suppose I'm separated 6 years, so I have 3 children, so I was juggling plates, you know, trying to keep everything going around. Separation obviously was difficult, you know, everything was unsettled. So I just needed a place to go.
Okay, so there was a lot of noise in your life.
Yes,
and
not a lot of
quiet for yourself.
Sure.
I don't know what age you are. Do you want to share that with us?
Sure, sorry. I'm 47.
47. Okay, so we're roughly pretty much the same age as me. So would you have had a typical Irish childhood in terms of mass on Sunday and, you know,
absolutely,
church in school and all the rest of it?
Yes, and we'd be sent to mass some Sundays and we wouldn't go, and we'd get the pamphlet at the church and we'd
that
bring it
sort
home.
Of thing.
Yes.
Okay, you're probably wondering where I'm going with this, but
okay.
I'm just curious to know, because I think that you reflect a lot of people in this country who might have tried to find an alternative to the church,
sure.
For example. Did you make a decision to say, I'm gone from religion, or did you drift from it? You know, was there a point in...
There was no definitive moment,
yeah.
I suppose, but it didn't have for me what I was looking for. You know, I didn't...
Like so many people.
Yes. So but I was missing something. I knew I was missing something.
So once upon a time, people would have gone to mass,
sure.
Or the priest or or confession or
yes.
Whatever, and said, this is where I need to go to unwind. And then something happened, as we could go into other reasons, but that's not what this interview is about.
Sure.
Or conversation is about. Then people say, what else is there? And you found yoga.
Yes.
Okay. And with that in mind, then you did all those lessons, and you started drifting into other realms of the yoga world. Is that how would you describe it, that you moved into, like, for example, the Bikram world?
Right.
Where did that come from?
So I was practicing normal Hatha yoga for about 3 years.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine suggested, listen, I went to Bikram yoga. I hadn't heard of Bikram yoga at the time. So she was up and explained to me exactly what it was. It was in a heated room, you know. It's similar. It's Hatha postures. Like, it's not, the postures aren't anything new.
Okay.
So I decided to go along this particular evening, and this particular friend couldn't make it. So I toddled on into the room and got set up, didn't know what to expect. Could feel the heat and go, no, that's okay. That's not too bad.
Yeah.
I came out of the class and I said, what has she put me through? What is this? What have I just gone through? Now, I live in Blanchardstown. My studio is very close to where I live.
Yes.
I got into the car and I'd be very familiar with where I live. But I went around about 3 times because I was so disorientated. I was just completely...
How many of you are in this room with the heat?
I'd say that on that particular evening it was about 22.
And is the room small enough?
You'd be comfortable enough. Like, you'd have enough space between the mats, you know, that type of way. Now I feel the more in the room, the better, because the energy goes up, you know, the more people that's in the room.
What's the point of the heat? It sounds like a torture chamber. So tell
well,
me, Kelly,
Bikram,
why would you put yourself through this?
Bikram would call it a torture chamber,
yeah,
all
right.
Because the heat basically allows you to get deeper into the postures without injury.
You're more supple, is
You're
that
more
it?
Supple,
okay.
Yeah. It's like, how would you say, working with metal and you're heating it up.
Okay, yeah, that's a good analogy.
So
yeah.
It would be the same with your body. So without doing injury, you wouldn't be able to get as deeply into the postures if you didn't have the heat.
Okay.
And also the heat helps you detoxify. Like, you're sweating profusely. So you really do. You feel as though you've cleansed your body when you come out of it.
Andy Murray, the tennis player.
Mm-hmm.
I think David Beckham.
Sure.
And then down to Raquel Welch and all these
Madonna.
Famous. Madonna. All say that this guy, Bikram,
mm-hmm. Sure.
Is the guy, or has been in the past.
Okay.
Who the hell is he?
Bikram Shiroi.
Yeah, tell me about him.
Well, he's from India, obviously. He claims that he was practicing yoga from a really young age. And he had his guru, who was Bishnu Ghosh. And he used to go study with him. And apparently people from his village used to go to this guru. or his guru, when they had any ailments, and his guru would write a prescription, and that prescription would be a series of postures to help with whatever ailment that they had. So people were coming and coming and coming, and then Bikram would come and he'd help his particular guru in the studios.
Sure.
So he's seen all these people coming, and he decided, well, listen, we can't cope with the amount of people here. So his thinking was, what I'll do is I'll set up a school. I will eventually set up a school, and I will teach people this sequence, these 26 postures and two breathing exercises. So then he left India, and he went to the States, and he set up his first studio in LA. So he drew a lot of attention from celebrities. It was this new craze that was going on. Yeah. Like he speaks constantly about Shirley MacLaine, Nixon, you know, who he apparently has taught and helped. So, yeah, so then he decided he was going to open up a school and invite people over so they could learn how to teach the sequence.
And so it began.
So it began.
It was Bikram mania.
That's it.
And all the celebrities wanted a piece of this guy.
Sure.
People were happy to pay him, as well, you know, lots of money. And I'm not giving out about that. That's the market. That's what
yes.
you do.
Sure.
And his personality seems to have been a bit peculiar. But he claims to have taught yoga to the Beatles, to NASA astronauts and whatever. The Nixon Museum have come back, library have come back and said, we've no record of this at all. And equally, pretty much he said that he was a champion of yoga when he was a kid. No paper trail for that at all. So the documentary, which I'm sure you've seen.
I have.
It suggests that he's a spoof, mm-hmm. but a very talented spoofer. Probably brilliant at yoga, would that be fair to say?
Yes, but amazing. He knows his onions, as you would say, inside out. Like he knows the body, you know, he does.
Okay, there's a sort of sordid twist in the tale. We'll get to just in just a moment. But let me ask you why you decided to go to him. To the man
to
himself.
Source?
Yeah, the source, exactly.
Yes.
Tell me about that, Kelly.
Because he was the source, because I realised the benefits of Bikram yoga in doing it myself. Mm. I've seen other people, how it's changed their lives, not just sort of in emotionally, but also physically. Injuries, scoliosis, arthritis. Like time and time again, I've seen it, I've witnessed it. So I wanted to go to the source, basically. And also it was a challenge because I was informed, like, this is no walk in the park. This is 9 weeks of you're going into a torture chamber.
How much did you have to save up to pay him?
Oh, 12,000.
A lot of money.
It was. I saved for about, I'd say hard for about 3 years. You know, and in the last year, my poor kids, there was no takeaways. You know, there is not, a very funny story actually, there was no underwear bought for me. I remember making the joke, listen, I can't afford to buy myself a pair of knickers now at this stage, right? And I got a good luck card from somebody and one of my students at the time who I was teaching, Mary, and in it was €20 and a little note going, now you can buy yourself a pair of knickers.
But how old were your kids at this time? Were they little or?
No, well, Jacob was little. Jacob is 8 now, so he
six.
Meg was 18 and then Sam was 15.
And were they saying, we are making sacrifices for you and your yoga classes? Or were they supportive, saying, we don't mind because this is your thing?
No, listen, when I first started yoga, it was they looked at me as if it was a phase that was going to, you know, just going to go off. It's like going to soccer, or, you know, a soccer match or, you know, every week or whatever. But it became such a big part of my life and they've seen how I was with it. They see me practicing regularly. They supported me. You know, like my daughter was called in to babysit I don't know how many times, especially in the last year, because I had to attend more classes. Obviously, when I was going to training, I had to actually up my ante on that. So I got great support now, in fairness.
You saved your 12 grand.
Yes.
And you headed to what part of the world? United States?
Acapulco.
Mm-hmm. He had to be there for a particular reason because he was under suspicion of sexual issues.
Sure.
We'll get to that in a minute, but I really want to follow your story first and then we'll sidebar over there in a moment. But you saved your money, you're hard earned, and you headed over there. What was the nature of the regime in Acapulco with Bikram?
As in what would be your normal
Monday
day?
To Friday or Saturday
or
something? So it
would be Monday to Saturday.
Okay.
And you would get up at, say, 7 o'clock in the morning or earlier, and your first class would be at 8 o'clock, your first Bikram practice. So that would be for about 2 hours.
And what was the heat in the room degrees-wise?
Well, the first day we arrived, actually, we were in the room, and it was an afternoon, actually, class. The first class was an afternoon class, and it was with Bikram. And it was very funny because he used to have, he has the podium and then he has his chair, his little couch.
His throne.
His right, yes. Yeah, and then if he was going to be teaching, it would be covered with this orange cover. So you'd know that he was teaching. We found this out later. We weren't aware of that at the time. So we were standing in class and the heat was absolutely immense. It was like no heat I had ever experienced before. And I'm standing there going, I'm not going to be able to survive 9 weeks in this. And you could see people dropping. People were collapsing. There were buckets down the back of the room with plastic bags in them. There were vomit buckets, we were told. So when you need to get sick, you could go there, but you don't leave the room. So I was like, what have I signed myself up for? So he walks in and anyway, in his grandeur, and he's...
Now, we have to explain his grandeur. He has a penchant for little... Yes, tiny
yes,
Speedos, and he's 70 plus, and he walks around with his ponytail in the Speedos. Yes. And I have to say that if that's what he does, and that's his look.
That's his thing. Yeah.
Would any part of you think
it's unique to him?
If he's not my bag now. Or
absolutely. Yeah, like, absolutely. Like if he was a bar of chocolate, he'd eat himself. Like he loves himself that much. Like, but you're looking and you're going, no, come on.
But yeah. Because he's so good at what he does, you have to see through that.
He's very unique. You know, he really is. That's the kindest probably word I could come up with. He's very unique, and only he would get away with it. You know.
So what's he doing on his throne with he's got air conditioning. He's the only one who gets the heat. The cold air on his back.
Yes.
Which is kind of odd, but he's the teacher. Maybe he's entitled to the special rules. Is he shouting at you? I found him quite profane and
yes, he can
difficult.
Be. He can be. He can be quite humorous. There were 75 in my training. He's had bigger. He's had 300, 400, 500 people in the room and he'd be training them. And he'd be talking you through the postures. He'd be bringing you through each of the postures. But no matter where you are in the room, like the moment you walk into his class, you know you're on and you cannot, you know, there's no hiding from him. If you do something wrong, he will find you.
Were you ever singled out?
Oh, yes.
What
happened? For doing posture and not doing the posture the correct way. And, you know, Blondie, and he used to call me the Marine Corps mum.
The Marine Corps mum? Why?
Yes. Because in the first 2 weeks, you have to deliver a dialogue of one posture in front of him. So I was delivering this posture and he asked me, was I in the Marine Corps? And I said, no, he said, do you have children? And I said, yes, I do. Oh, God love them, he said. He said, you're a Marine Corps mum. And my delivery was quite strong and it was quite, so that's how
was he complimenting you there? So I'm confused.
In some way,
okay,
yes,
yeah.
In some way.
Okay,
I don't know
Yogi flirting. So, yeah, I, don't, so
no.
I don't understand
No, he definitely
what he's
wasn't
doing
flirting
there.
With me.
No. Because that was one of his things was he flirted with the women in the course and that is not what got him in trouble ultimately. That
yes.
He said to one of the women, you know, after the class, where are we going with this? And she's going, what are you talking about? And
this
then,
is in the documentary.
In the documentary.
Yes.
And wasn't he accused? Let's go there for a moment. That
sure.
He was accused of
he
rape, I think,
accused.
At some
yes,
stage.
Yes,
and,
yes.
So did you find there was any of that
I didn't,
in
no.
the air?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I found that he has no filter. He doesn't filter anything that he says. He can be quite insulting to people, which was very uncomfortable to witness. You know, if people were overweight sometimes, he would call them out on it. He would call them fatty. He would curse from the podium as well.
Why was week five known to some people as sex week? Did you ever hear of that expression?
No, because by the time I got to week five, Ryan, sex was the last thing on my mind.
Really?
I was broken at come week five.
And
yeah.
Did he at any point have physical contact with you? And I don't mean that in a peculiar sense,
sure.
But in the course of a yoga class.
Yeah, he would adjust. He would come down every now and again and he would make adjustments.
And did he stand on you at one point?
Yes, he did. That was during a lecture.
Yeah.
And it was like a Q&A thing. So we would ask about certain postures. And I was asking about this particular posture, camel, and a technique. And he caught me up and he asked me to do camel. He had a look at it to see what way I was doing it.
Yeah.
And I'd asked the question about compressing into the lower limber, into the lower spine. And no, that's ridiculous. And you'd have to be quite brave to ask him a question.
Okay.
Because, you know, he would take the knees from under you, basically, mm-hmm. You know, if, you know, it didn't suit him. So then I'd asked him this question and it irked him a bit. And he says, now for this, for your punishment. And it was tongue in cheek.
Okay.
I'm going to stand on you. I'm going. So he did. But like, he's light. It's not, you
it
know,
wasn't like he was
goes,
trying
oh
to hurt
God.
You.
Not
the,
at all.
In the yoga world, it's not an insane thing to imagine. I can think of somebody. Another former pupil said that the training took 9 weeks. It was part humiliation, part benediction. Did you feel that he was a kind of almost a quasi spiritual guru, or did you just see him as the yoga guy?
And I wasn't looking for that from him.
Really?
No, I wasn't looking for that from him. He wouldn't be my guru. I wouldn't look up to him in a spiritual way at all whatsoever.
And did you know Kelly before you went out to Acapulco about the sexual assault allegations?
There were rumours, yeah, I'd heard the rumours, but I didn't hear the details.
Okay, and did it give you any cause for concern?
For myself?
Well, to be even going to support or to go
no,
to classes
because
with somebody
I,
with a cloud
how I squared
hanging
it
on.
Off with myself
yeah,
was,
tell me about
yeah,
that.
Was that I separated the practice from the man. The practice worked, you know, the practice, I've seen exactly what it did. I know what it does for me. And that's how I squared it off with. It was the practice that I was in.
And you were okay. It reminds me of people who say, I won't listen to Michael, sorry, listen to Michael Jackson's
yes,
music.
Yes, I've heard that, yeah.
But I feel that he might be guilty of something else, mm-hmm. that they squared that off too. And some other people will say, no, they're unsquarable.
I understand that. And that's their viewpoint. But mine was, I squared it off. I fell in love with the practice and I seen the benefits of it. And I separated the practice from the man.
So he fled the States with an outstanding damages fee of $6.8 million. And he went to kind of hide or in plain sight in Acapulco. And that's where you found him.
Yes.
And how many weeks did you stay there?
9 weeks, actually 10 weeks in total.
And what did you come away from that experience with? And I mean that practically and intellectually, emotionally.
Sure.
Tell me about that.
The 9 weeks, they were so challenging. You know, I don't think I could have prepared myself for it, although I tried. I still wasn't aware exactly, you know. I remember phoning home and I was FaceTiming my yoga teacher, Anne-Marie, who was an inspiration for me.
Yeah.
And I think it was week two and she says, oh, you're still smiling. So it's still.
So you survived.
This is in week two, you know. Yeah. But come week five, as I said, I was broken. I stood in the middle of the studio, you know, where we trained, and the tears were running down my face. Your body is so sore because of the amount of training that you're doing. Like, it's so intense.
Yeah.
And I stood there going, I hate this practice. When I get home, I'm never doing this. But apparently that's the week five, week six, where you do hit the wall, you know. But then after that, you know, you're on the home front, you know, and I'd gone over there to get the certificate and I wasn't coming home without it. You know, I'd made sacrifices. My children had made sacrifices. You know, I missed my partner. I missed my children. And I said, well, I wasn't coming home without it. And I realised that, like, I was stronger. I had to dig deep. And I did, you know, really, really deep. So
do you give Bikram yoga classes now?
I would teach, in Kumain in Bikram, Dublin 15. I haven't been teaching in a couple of months. I changed jobs, so everything was a little bit up in the air. So I'm hoping to get back to it fairly soon. Yeah.
And I noticed that some people internationally who've done the course and who have had Bikram, because the big thing is it's the brand and that's what sells.
Yeah.
But because of the documentary and the allegations and so on, they've taken his name off it.
I've seen that.
Would that be something you would consider doing under no circumstances?
No, it's the Bikram practice. And that's like you could say it's hot yoga. There's a difference between hot yoga and the Bikram sequence. You know, hot yoga, you can have any different types of postures. It won't be the same sequence, you know, as you go into every studio.
Yeah.
You go worldwide and you go to a Bikram class, it'll be the same 26 postures and 2 breathing exercises.
Wasn't there a bishop who said, am I right in saying, who said that yoga was replacing religion and that it's not a good thing? What do you make of that? Just to go back to the point earlier on, what do you think of it?
I laughed. I really did. I
think a lot of people probably felt this in a similar way. Yes. What would you say, Kelly, finally, to people listening this morning who have never once in their life considered the prospect of buying a yoga mat or doing the downward dog or any other move? What would you say to them to suggest that this could change their life? I'd be curious to know that.
I would say that this sequence is called the beginner sequence.
Yeah.
And that to go with an open mind. You don't have to. It's not about getting the full expression of any posture, you know, but just go do what you can and just give it a try. As I said, the first time I took the class, I was blown away, but I was called back. And most people who practice Bikram for a period of time, they can go away, they can go to do other activities, they'll go to the gym or they'll go wherever else or they'll try a different yoga practice, but they always come back.
They always come back. There's your answer, isn't it?
They always come back.
Kelly, thanks for coming in and speaking so honestly about your experience with Bikram yoga. And I hope your practice goes really well.
Thank you.
Kelly, Yoga with Kelly is where people will find you on Facebook. And yeah, and I hope life is good to you. Thanks for your time this morning.
And thank you.
At 11 minutes to 10. At bang on 9:30, you're also welcome this Wednesday morning. 51551 is the text number. And, you know, last week we were talking about family and memories and how your mind can play tricks on you. And we don't always quite know. Nothing is quite what it seems, is what I'm saying. And one such person with a story along those lines is David Diebold, who joins us now. Good morning, David. Nice
morning.
To see you.
How
Thanks for coming in. So you've been writing about this idea of families and connection and memory and how it all works. And with that in mind, let's go back to, we're going to go to, I think, America. Would that be right to start with your story?
Mom and dad. Well, I mean, I grew up, as I was saying to you before, like in a three-bedroom house out the South Dublin. So I thought everyone's family was sort of odd, like mine.
Yeah.
But my parents had come here to Ireland when I was about 3 years old from Los Angeles. And my father was a... he was a journalist on the LA Times, a jazz musician. He played with Louis Armstrong at one point, Perez Prado.
Right.
But he was a newspaper man, and he took a year's leave of absence to come over here and write a book about Dermot McMurray. Now, the thing I think that was happening in Los Angeles at the time, the impetus for this was, he'd interviewed Martin Luther King 6 weeks before he was assassinated. Now, it was a throwaway piece. I mean, he even said there was nothing interesting about the piece at all. It was a 500-word article. He was visiting a local school or something. But one of the things that Martin Luther King had said in that interview was that it wasn't a question of if he got assassinated. It was a question of when.
Really?
And I think when it actually happened, it hit. Well, it was one of the things that was happening at the time that hit Dad pretty hard. The Watts race riots had sort of happened.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that was sort of the straw that broke the whatever was the Manson murders sort of happened around that time as well. So now Dad had two teenage daughters, three teenage daughters, and a preteen son, and the eldest of which were identical twins, beautiful. One had done some modeling, and they were sort of hippies on the LA sort of scene. And so
your dad said, right, it's all getting a bit chaotic over here. Let's go over to Ireland and settle. So you, your mom and your dad settle in Ireland.
That's
and
based.
You're only, what, three or four? You're young.
That's right. So I was three. Now, I think one of the reasons talking about memory, one of the reasons I remember so much about that time was because it was such a time of change. I mean, Los Angeles in 1970 compared to Dublin in 1970 was quite a difference.
I can imagine, yeah.
And I mean, my dad has described it since as like going back in time. You know, I mean, you didn't see horse-drawn carts in Los Angeles, but I mean, right up until the 80s, as you know, you did in Dublin.
Sure.
I mean, you still do at the Liberties or whatever, you know. So it was immersive change. It was extraordinary, profound change. And I remember a lot about it. One of the pieces I write about in the book is when we moved down to Wexford. So one of the first places we lived was in this little cliff-top house perched above the beach, in fact, where they ended up filming the D-Day landings.
Kirklo Beach,
very near there. And Dad was writing this book basically out in the shed. And I just remember the image of seeing him through that window as he wrote this book. And I was, as all children do, you adapt very quickly. I went to the local school. I took to Irish. There was a book called Dahi Laka.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's how I gelled
with Irish.
That was your
Bible. Yeah,
that was it. Yeah.
Yeah, great. So you got into the Irish system, and I think you were about 7 years old when your sister Julie came over from the States, and just you said it was very of its time. They were hippie chicks, to use the expression. They were almost otherworldly. So here she comes over to visit you and the family in Ireland, and this is the critical point in your story, because your world was completely. It's like somebody took their finger and flicked the globe. And everything changed.
Yeah, well, Julie showed up at the door. I knew I had family that we'd left behind in the States, and I knew I had two sisters that were in America. So one day Julie arrived to see us, and I think one of the first things she did, in my memory, I answered the door and it was just the two of us. I don't know. She took me into a room and she said, "Do you know who I am?" And I said, "Yeah, you're my sister, Julie, from Los Angeles." And she said, "No, I'm your mother." So I think I was about, I would have been six, going on seven.
And there had been no conversations.
No conversations whatsoever.
What a sucker punch for a child.
Well, I think I was, you know, children are adapt so easily to any story, I think.
It's still a big thing to have to process at that age.
It was a profound thing. And I think the sucker punch really was for Mom, who came into the room to find that the thing that she wasn't really ready to tell me had been told.
How did that go? Can you remember that? Because it's such a big thing. Is it etched in your mind, or is it blurry?
I think children are our emotional radars. I think you know they pick up even on what's not said. Mm. They pick on up on the mood or the thing. Mm. I think I was delighted because I was suddenly the center of attention. You know, and Julie said she was staying. She was staying for a while. She moved in basically up the road. She had a husband with her now, who I never called a stepdad. I never called Julie Mom. Mom was the person that brought me up, and she was right until she died. And Dad was Dad. My biological parents, I always called by their first name.
Can you remember how your mother, your mom, as we call her, dealt with your sister
believe me.
But the woman you believed was your sister. Can you recall how she responded to the fact that you just had this revelation?
I sensed that Mom was very, very protective and a little annoyed, probably more than a little annoyed that this had this revelation. When she wasn't planning on this, and in fact, she wasn't planning on seeing Julie anytime soon, as far as I can tell. But I think, she was not happy about it.
Julie then stuck around.
Julie stuck around
in Ireland. Did you find yourself as a child might do in school or with friends, going, "You'll never guess."
Every day.
If
we're out for dinner with Mom and Dad, I'd tell the waitress as she came over to, I mean, I talk about this in the book as well, that moment that all parents have where their child says something completely out of bounds or out of left field to a complete stranger. I did that all the time.
Yes.
It must have been a harsh.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it's kind of entertaining in a sort of almost a sad way, but you do describe how some people felt unable to deal with your revelation and your honesty with it.
Well, I mean, I'd go home. Again, this was Ireland in the mid 70s. To me, there was nothing strange about my story because it was my story. And I thought everyone had a strange story.
Which they do, just been in Ireland, we just didn't talk about it.
Well, this is it.
Exactly.
Exactly. And, you know, the title of the book, This Is How We Dance, is the stories and memories that we dance around and don't really talk about. And those are what those stories are.
What an Irish description of a serious discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, look, I'd go home with friends from school, and I would the first thing I would say to their mother as they were making lunch, they would say, "Oh, how are you? How's your mom?" And I'd say, "Well, which one? You know, because my sister is actually my mother. You'll never guess what."
Yeah.
And, you know, routinely that was met with, "How nice. Would you like peanut butter or ham?" Yeah.
"Let's move on," says they. "Let's move on." Did it ever come to a head then between Julie and your mom?
I, from what I understand, and it's just the thing about memory is sometimes you're not sure what you remember, whether you remember being told something or most times we remember remembering something. We remember a memory. Mm. What I remember, and I think that's the difference between sort of exhaustive biography or exhaustive autobiography and memoir, because the important thing is bringing to someone to that how you felt. And how I felt about that situation when it came to a head was that Mom gave Julie an ultimatum and sort of said, "Look, you're either here or you're not. you know.
Was she flighty, Julie?
Well,
she?
Yeah, I'd say that in the most affectionate way.
Okay.
You know, she was just over here to see me last year. I mean, I love her to death, but she'd be the first to admit that certainly in the mid-70s.
When you were a boy, and she was probably only a girl in some ways,
yeah.
You were kind of half coming and going. Mm-hmm. What was your relationship with her?
With who?
With Julie.
With Julie. We were inseparable almost immediately for the entire year, a year and a half. And I think much to Mom's dismay, I mean, I would leave school, be supposed to go home. I was going to St. Paul's in Glenageary, which is gone now, I think, down in Glasthool there. And we just lived literally five doors up. My sister lived a good 10-minute, 15-minute walk away. I'd walk to her flat instead of going home. And my mother wouldn't know where I was, of course. Yeah. So there was a couple of things that I think sort of brought things to a head. And
so we go to the ultimatum then that your mum gave to your sister, who obviously becomes your mother. What did she say to her? What was the nature of the ultimatum? You're in or out?
Well, from what I understand, yeah, it was. Like, are you here to stay or not?
Yeah.
I think talking to Julie in retrospect, she has said that she just sort of felt that it was better for me if she left again, because she sort of felt that Mom was giving me more of a hard time when she was around, to sort of assert her authority or to assert her role as mother, you know? So what happened was Julie just told me one day out of the blue that she was leaving again, and I didn't see her again for 11 years.
11 years. That's a lot of separation, and because it got the sense there was jubilation, and now you have separation.
We were inseparable, yeah.
Gosh.
I'd be climbing all over her all the time, and the affection was reciprocal, you know.
And how did you feel when she said, "I'm gone, I have to leave for your own good"?
I think, you know, in retrospect, I think I was fairly devastated. I don't think I would have recognized the symptoms of sort of depression or separation anxiety, the things that I would recognize now in my own kids.
Again, not talked about much at that time anyway.
No.
Yeah.
So I remember, you know, crying a lot in the playground, going off on my own, trying to explain how I felt to other kids and feeling that they just didn't get it, you know. So I think I immediately sort of felt a little bit older than my years, because I was able to articulate certain, emotional things that were happening to me that they weren't able to understand. And so I think that rolling sort of forward over the next few years, I think I felt a little, you know, maybe a little distrustworthy or untrustworthy about, or distrusting of relationships and that kind of thing. I'd worry that people were going to leave.
It's completely understandable given what you've said. It doesn't get much better, because then what, you were 12 years old when your mum, Polly, makes an announcement. Or no, she doesn't actually make an announcement. She kisses you goodbye as you go to school.
Well, no, it's not quite entirely accurate. What happened was around that time, she started to go back to the States on visits and stay for a few months. She was quite unhappy in Ireland then. I mean, she grew to love it in her much, much later years. But back then, she wasn't entirely happy. And whenever she could afford to, she would go back and stay a little longer. So in my sort of early to mid-teens, she did say that she was going over, in fact, to look after my dad's mother, who had had a stroke or something. It was while she was there she wrote home and said she wasn't going to be back,
and you were gone.
But I remember vividly, and I write about the very, very last morning that she left, and the last breakfast she made for me.
Yeah, like before she headed off.
An egg
States.
On toast and a hot chocolate. You just remember these last motherly sort of things, and that hug, and you know the feel of, you know, the tear on her face on my cheek. And still being able to taste sort of breakfast as I was, and trying to process this. So yeah, then it was just dad and myself.
So you kind of lost two mothers, essentially.
Well, over time, yes. By my sort of mid-teens, it was just dad and myself in the house.
I'm going to jump ahead to the 90s then, David, when you and your girlfriend, as she was then, she's your wife now, Emily, mm-hmm. and you went to the States to start a new life. Mm-hmm. And you have four children in total, but yeah. you were starting a life, a family, and That's so right. on. What made you think, I'd like to know more about
my biological father.
Exactly.
Well, when we got married, our very first child, Zachary, who's all grown up, healthily, I'll add, and living in Brussels now, was born at 26 weeks. So he was very premature. He weighed about like a bag of sugar. He was 2 pounds. And in a little sort of aquarium that they keep him in. And we could only prod him with, lollipop sticks or whatever.
Yes.
And he needed a blood transfusion. And when they went to ask me about my family history, which they had to, was San Francisco. It was, it was early 90s. I said I only knew my mother's side. I didn't know anything about my father's side. I couldn't give blood in the end. Emily couldn't give blood either because she'd just given birth. And so, he had to take a stranger's blood. I mean, it doesn't sound like much now, but then it was sort of as a young in my mid-20s with that little lad, I wanted to give him something, so I couldn't even give him the history on my father's side. So I think at some point Emily said, just for medical history at least, you need to sort this out. So I was given the number of a private investigation firm called Seekers of the Lost from the closing credits of an Oprah Winfrey show about Vietnam veterans trying to find lost buddies.
Yeah.
And I gave them a call and they said, sure. This is, before internet, any of that.
So this is gumshoe stuff.
This is back when you wanted to call home from the States to Ireland, like you had to queue up at a payphone with 2 pounds of quarters, and so this was the era in which I was trying to track this fella down. And anyway, Secrets of the Lost, I gave them, $200, sent them a check, and I had my biological father's name and what I thought was probably his date of birth on this birth certificate. And they got back to me as soon as the check cleared, I guess, but within 36 hours with three names that fit the bill. Here's the thing, you sort of forget how vast America is.
Yeah.
So there were three men by the name of Bill who all had the same birth date.
Yes.
And could have been my biological father. The very first one I called, now I remember vividly the day, I was actually working as an intern at Viacom or in Channel 31 as a TRTing tapes and putting bars and tone on tapes for broadcast, actually. And I went into a empty studio and gave him a call, phone over in the control booth. And I gave the first number on the list a call, and I knew it was him. By the way, he said, "Buddy, I think you got the wrong number," and hung up.
Why were you convinced?
I just felt that the response was too terse. He wasn't even interested in wondering, best of luck, but I hope you find the guy or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got an address on the basis of that phone number, and I wrote him a note, and I said, look, I said, I'm not looking for an Oprah Winfrey moment here. And I think that was the line that got him. I said, here's how I found you
on
the credits of this show. I'm not looking for an Oprah Winfrey moment, nothing weepy, no big reunion.
No drama.
Yeah. I said, but you need to know you have a grandson who is doing very well, but born very premature. And I just need to know a bit of medical history here at the very least.
Yeah, well, you approached it really well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds remarkably mature for me.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the bit I'm misremembering. But anyway, he agreed to meet me at the side of a highway in a seedy little all-day bar. And there he was. He, as it turned out, had been a roadie or a technician with a stage technician with a band called Three Dog Night in the late 60s who did quite well, American sort of hit band. And he had got into a bit of trouble on the road from what I understand. Again, I don't know if this was the late 60s, early 70s, but it was definitely contributed to our separation. So he went to jail And I'm pretty sure that's why I couldn't bring up the subject of my biological father with mom or dad growing up.
Because they knew.
Because, well, they would, mom would just start crying, you know. So
did you form a good relationship with this man, Bill?
Again,
your father.
He treated me like a rock star right from the off, you know. And if I were to be honest with myself, I think I had sort of a bit of an addiction to that sort of affection from when I was, 6 or 7 years old, and Julie had lavished me with that.
Yeah.
So now I was mid 20s with, as it turned out, at that point we had a second child who was just a baby. And I went down to Los Angeles to meet him then at the LA Expo, because now he was a special effects manufacturer, or inventor, and a special effects man, licensed by the federal government to blow stuff up, which I thought was the coolest thing in the world. And he had a booth at this trade show for the motion picture industry. And there, manning the booth with him, was the half-brother I never knew I had, 16-year-old William Jr. And which was weird. So Bill promptly, as he would do, just landed me in that one and went off for a patrol around the trade fair and left myself and Willie manning this booth of special effects.
Yeah,
I knew nothing about. And someone came over this with a little entourage and said, "Is your dad around?" Bill here, because I love his effects. I'm using them on a movie that I'm shooting at the moment about the Titanic. So it was James Cameron.
Oh my goodness,
came over. So when he went off and Bill came back, I'm like, you'll never guess who was just here. Yeah. James Cameron! Cameron! And he was like, yeah, sure. Did you say hi? I mean, I hope you gave him a brochure.
Yeah.
And he said, no, he's using your stuff.
So he was kind of mixing in those.
Absolutely, yeah.
Sadly, Bill would go on to die of cancer but you had forged that relationship with him, which I'm sure offered some class of relief to you. You're both your parents as who brought you up.
Yeah, mom and dad are both gone now.
They're gone now. But your birth mother, who you mentioned, your sister mother, as you refer to her sometimes, is alive and well.
Julie, as I mostly refer to her, she's alive and well and living in Michigan, and she came over to see me last year. Bill had a huge sort of house out in the countryside, but sort of ranch property out in Oregon. And we had visited him a couple of times with our now four kids from Ireland. And again, he would lavish us every year with amazing presents and everything. And I just got a call 1 year out of the sort of blue from his wife, Catherine, who said, if you want to say goodbye to your dad, you better get over here because he's dying. So I literally hopped on a plane. Emily got me a flight to San Francisco, and I got off that plane and ran to the first desk I saw, burst into tears and said, my dad's dying and in Portland. And, you know, the woman was like, honey, slow down. You need to get to Portland. Give me your credit card. Now run.
Yeah.
And I just got there. Unfortunately, at that point, he was in the cancer had metastasized, and he couldn't speak to me anymore. But I stayed up all night and I talked to him anyway. So I got some sort of closure. I mean, one of the things, if it's appropriate to sort of start to wind up on, is that I think one of the themes in This Is How We Dance in the book is you don't always get closure. You know, obviously, one of the things is that everyone's family is a bit odd when you scratch beneath the surface, and those things should be embraced, I think, and in time, even if you feel it's too odd to handle right now, eventually you'll get to a point where you'll realize it's something to sort of celebrate and to love. But the important thing, I think, is that things don't always come to a full circle or to a conclusion. You don't always get to say what you wanted to say when your parents are dying or at that moment. And that's okay. Life isn't all about perfect endings. And sometimes it's a very imperfect ending. And This Is How We Dance is that dance, that sort of, well, not to be too hokey about it, but it's that life dance, that imperfect, odd, strange, life that doesn't always come to a full circle. You don't always get to say or do all the things you wanted to when you could.
I like that. I like the complication and the lack of clean lines sometimes, because life isn't linear,
it really
as
isn't.
You know, in so many respects. This is How We Dance is the book by our guest this morning, David Diebold, who... we, of course, all readers of Scary's News know that you and Emily put that together and a lot of work into it. We need local papers. We need that local news. So keep that going.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming to share a story with such a candor. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and our listeners have too.
Also, want to say just to support local independent bookstores, because that's where is selling. All the Bookhaven branches, Gutter Bookshop, Books Upstairs, Winding Stair, all these lovely
all
little
the bookshops.
These
are
the great
bookshops
where this is How We Dance.
David, thanks for your time. Good luck to you
and
the family.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming to see us this
what
morning.
A pleasure.
Absolutely. It's 5 to 10. Danny Miller is someone who has a difference, and I'm going to tell you that this is going to be an unusual listening experience. Danny communicates through augmentative communication technology, and effectively, he's unable to speak in a way that you or I might speak without the use of technology. And he has completed his Leaving Cert. He's had this incredible technology that you're about to hear for the last year. So it's a different interview in that we've had to prearrange all the questions in order to give Danny a chance to respond to them. And then we'll get a chance to learn something about Danny's experiences. Before we go to the questions that we've given you in advance, can I just say welcome, Danny, to the studio. Nice to meet you.
It's good.
And you are how old?
Lucky.
Okay. And you're from what part of the country?
It's good.
Very good. Well, thanks for coming in to see us today. And we have plenty of questions for you. So let's will we get down to business?
Yeah.
Let's do it. First question I have for you is, what is your difference? And why do you use technology to help you communicate?
My formal diagnosis or basis for my difference is that I have diplegia cerebral palsy as well as severe expressive communication difficulties. I cannot use speech as my primary means of communication because I find it difficult to get my mouth to move quickly enough to make up words. This affects the clarity of my speech. Take care not to be fooled by my appearance, because inside my thinking and language processing is just the same as everybody else. I use augmentative communication technology to communicate because my device, the SL50, provides me with a voice output to interact with other people. It means I can have meaningful conversations. I am sure you have heard the technology being used before if you think about Stephen Hawking, the physicist. Mm-hmm. I do not think I am as smart as he was. What we had in common was a good sense of humor and a way to communicate.
Okay, now that gives us a great insight into who you are through this technology.
Yeah.
How has technology helped you to communicate?
Using this device, I think I weave into conversations pretty damn easy. I use my device every day to express my thoughts and feelings, to talk with my family and friends, and at college to participate in group discussions.
And that obviously eases your way through life in a way before could never have happened without this technology. So what do you think, Danny, your life would be like without the technology you're using for our interview today?
Non-existent. Can you imagine knowing everything you want to say inside your head, but not being able to say it out loud? It can be quite isolating, and people can feel quite awkward and uncomfortable. When you cannot speak out loud and respond to questions or participate normally, in inverted commas, in a conversation, people can be very judgmental, and many people have thought I am intellectually disabled or just plain stupid.
I'm going to ask you a question off the script, so you can answer spontaneously with your technology. Is that right? How annoying is it when people treat you like a fool?
I guess it's annoying, but I always know I'll get the last laugh.
Good. We go back to the to my next question on the list that we sent you, which was about school. And was it difficult for you to get through school?
It was very difficult, but some of that was my own fault. Think of your worst teenage nightmare as a parent, then multiply that by 10. Instead of me being brave enough to embrace my difference, I tried too hard to be like everybody else, and this just did not work. I used the note facility on my mobile phone, which meant that I was pretty much silent throughout secondary school. People never heard what I had to say because it took me a long time to type what I wanted to say. They lost interest waiting, and then they had to read the notes from my phone, which made the whole interaction very fake and awkward. On reflection, I should have been braver, because this communication technology, the SL50, levels the playing field, so to speak, if you pardon the pun.
Mm, yeah, but it makes great sense. And can you give us an idea, Danny, of a typical day for you?
I probably have as normal a day as everybody else, and probably dislike the mundane routine just as much as everybody else. I digress when I say that I did my leaving certificate in 2018. After that, I went to Brill Institute of Further Education and completed a TV and video production course in 2019, and this year I am doing a performing arts course in Roslyn Park in Sandy Mound. But back to your question, every day I get a lift to the DART, take the DART to Sandy Mound, walk to the college from the DART, do my course, eat my lunch, etc., etc. Just the normal mundane routine like everybody else. Once a week I go to a physical therapist and a personal trainer. Both help me to stretch and exercise and keep my body as physically healthy as possible given the limitations of cerebral palsy on a body. I watch a lot of movies and regularly write reviews on the movies I have seen and then publish my reviews on the website Letterboxd.com. I dream most days about being a successful movie director, like Quentin Tarantino or Harmony Korine.
Love Tarantino. Yeah. Loved it. Have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah.
Do you like it?
It's the best movie of last year.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. Well, except Joker. No, you think Tarantino's better than that? No. Okay, gotcha. Now we've had a look at your CV. Very impressive. What would you mentioned there? You'd like to be a director. What other things would you aim towards?
Medium to long term, I would like to work in the entertainment industry, possibly as a script writer or music supervisor, or if I caught a lucky break and made the right contacts go all the way and become a director. Short term, I want to finish my course in Roslyn Park, and then my mom thinks I should go to UCD to do a BA in humanities.
For what it's worth, I think your mum's right. I think you'd love it there and get that experience in college. But I don't know if you need that, if that's helping your argument or making it worse for you, I don't know. But anyway, let me ask you about, Danny, about getting work. Do you think you'll have difficulty getting work, or is the world a better place?
As my mom often says, could you not have chosen a more competitive industry to be interested in? So getting work is proving to be really difficult. I have sent my CV to most of the contacts on the Irish Film and Television database. I have not received any response. It is complicated because I cannot pick up the phone to talk. Maybe I need an agent. Look, I have applied for part-time jobs in bookstores close to where I live because I love reading too, but my expressive speech or lack of it makes people feel awkward, So I have not to date secured any part-time work either.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. People aren't enlightened enough to realise that you have all the smarts required for any of the jobs you describe, and yet people can't see past what it is we're talking about today. Just briefly on your interest in movies, Danny, where does that all come from?
I do remember being 14. My parents were out at a Christmas party. We had just gotten Netflix. I started to browse through the movie titles. I spotted Reservoir Dogs and holy hell, a life-changing moment. Mm. After watching that movie, I never saw movies the same way again. It is an art, a representation of a person's vision, and I began to think I could get my vision out there if I tried. That movie gave me hope that people might listen to what I had to say if I could communicate in the way that a movie communicates. Ultimately, my speech difficulty would become insignificant.
Mm. I think that from talking to you today, we as a society have as much catching up to do with you rather than the other way around. Would that be a fair analysis?
I think so. But I am willing to wait. Slow and steady wins the race.
Those wise words to end our interview this morning. Danny, it's been great to see you. Thanks for coming in to see us today. I look forward to seeing your name in the credits of a movie when I'm going to the cinema in Dunleary soon. Thanks so much. Danny Miller joining us in studio this morning. Actually, even your name has a movie director's ring to it, doesn't it? This movie directed by Danny Miller. I can see it already. It's going to be great. The future is bright. You're so welcome, Danny. Thanks for being with us this morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The text number is 51551.